From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we start this hour in St. Louis, where protesters led a silent march this morning after more than 80 people were arrested last night in the third day of protests after a judge found former officer Jason Stockley, who is white, not guilty of first-degree murder in the 2011 fatal shooting of motorist Anthony Lamar Smith, who is black. Stockley maintains his innocence. He said he feared Smith posed a threat to his life because Smith refused to put up his hands and reached along a seat to where a gun was found. But prosecutors questioned police accounts of a gun, and the head of the NAACP St. Louis is asking the Justice Department to immediately review the acquittal. Meanwhile, last night's arrest occurred after sunset when the official peaceful protest ended and turned violent, with some protesters smashing windows, overturning trash cans. Police say they were throwing rocks and chemicals at police. Some reporters and protesters tweeted out, though, that they were fenced in by police. The AP and photojournalist David Carson reported hearing police chanting, "Whose streets? Our streets," in the fashion of the Black Lives Matter movement. So that was last night. Nancy Fowler, reporter with St. Louis Public Radio, was at the protest this morning. Nancy, what was the atmosphere there?
Yeah, so people began gathering in downtown St. Louis right across from the main post office about 7 o'clock. And people seemed to be feeling it was a sense of ease and just being there, being present for a march whose destination was really unknown by even some of the people in it, as well as, of course, the observers.
Well, tell us more about this case. It started with a police chase. The police were chasing Mr. Smith's car. The officer, Jason Stockley, made some comments on tape, and there was a gun involved. Remind us.
Yeah, like you said, it was 2011, and Anthony Lamar Smith was suspected of drug dealing, and that led to a high-speed police chase by officer at the time, Jason Stockley, and his partner. And minutes before, the officers stopped Smith's car by running into it. Stockley was recorded on the police car cam saying, "We're going to kill this, don't you know?" Mm-hmm. Shortly after that, Stockley fired several shots at Smith, 15 seconds, apparently, after he got out of the police car. And, yes, a gun was found in Smith's car, and it only had Stockley's DNA on it.
So the prosecutors claimed that he had placed it there. Mr. Smith's DNA was not on the gun in the car.
That's correct. That's what they're saying.
Well, the judge in the case, Judge Timothy Wilson, said he agonized over the decision. But why did he make the decision?
Well, he just said he found that basically the evidence did not rise to the level of the charges that— There just wasn't enough evidence to meet those benchmarks.
Yeah. So what are organizers of these protests saying they will do now?
They seem to have come into this very organized with lessons learned from the Ferguson protests. They are planning to do something every day, often more than once a day. They say they have a goal for each event and that they are planning to peacefully protest from here until some unknown time.
Look, we learned over the weekend that U2, the band, canceled its upcoming St. Louis concert. What's the general feeling in St. Louis about the verdict, about the upset around the verdict, and about what it might mean for the city?
Well, you know, of course it's mixed, as is, you know, St. Louis is a very divided city, so I'm sure there are those who, you know, just upset about the concert. But then there are people, many people, you know, understand that economic impact is the way to make a difference. And they believe that the more that that happens, the more that they will be heard. And yes, other people feel inconvenienced. They feel put out. They feel angry, perhaps, if they don't understand what it is the protesters are doing and why they're doing it.
That's Nancy Fowler, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Nancy, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, President Trump is in New York today for the UN General Assembly. He will speak at the UN tomorrow, an organization he's had tough words for in the past. Here he is during the campaign.
The United Nations is not a friend of democracy. It's not a friend to freedom. It's not a friend even to the United States of America, where, as you know, it has its home.
Joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hey, Jeremy.
And do you expect the president to keep up his criticism of the UN tomorrow during his speech?
Yes, but in a much milder and more muted fashion. We got a little preview of that this morning when he popped in on a meeting on UN reform there in New York. The General Assembly is already underway. And he made some remarks about how the United Nations needs to get reformed and needs to downsize. But this was not entirely out of line with some of the statements we've heard from the new Secretary General. From the new Secretary General of the UN, and they seem to have a warm handshake together. And so the president was not being as harsh as he was in front of some of those rallies, and certainly not engaging in that America First rhetoric that we have sometimes heard.
Still, how do you think he'll be received tomorrow during his speech at the UN? Do you expect some countries to walk out or sit on their hands or anything like that?
More likely to sit on their hands than walk out. Cool reception, perhaps. He certainly has been very, very harsh with the organization in the past. He's talked about how it doesn't really serve any of its ends and is corrupt, and that is not going to be the message they hear tomorrow, but they may be protesting a message they've heard previously. Most of them, though, I think, are going to listen to him quite seriously and politely because at this particular moment, the real crisis facing the United Nations is not an internal one, and it's not Donald Trump, it's North Korea, right, and what to do about North Korea.
One issue that will surely come up during the UN General Assembly is the Paris Climate Agreement. Now, the president has said the U.S. is going to withdraw from that deal. But over the weekend, there was a report in The Wall Street Journal that maybe the administration is changing its mind and might stay in. What's going on here?
A lot of people think that the Wall Street Journal has a pretty good pipeline into the White House, and this is another one of those issues where the official White House position seems to be at odds with what comes leaking out from some elements within the White House. And there may be some method in this apparent confusion because the administration likes to have some of these issues both ways. They can talk to people who feel we should be going forward with our commitment to the Paris Agreement, even after having announced it that we are going to pull out, and thereby pleasing the base voters for Donald Trump last year, many of whom seem to have felt that that climate agreement was not favorable, right, to the United States and had been told that by Donald Trump.
Ron, what about the political story that dominated the news last week, Trump's possible second deal with the Democrats in as many weeks? Listen here to Republican strategist Alex Castellanos on ABC's This Week. He said he sees this, Trump's doing deal with the Democrats, as the beginning maybe of a three-party system in the U.S.
But he's figured out that if it's a three-party race in 2020, he can win with 40.
He'll always have 40, and that's the
geometry. Republicans may take a beating in 2018, but you're right, Donald Trump won't.
The suggestion there is that he can win with 40. If you couldn't hear what Alex Castellano was saying, he's saying, you know, if he splits it up into the Trumpians, the Republicans and the Democrats, he does pretty well.
If you believe that he would always have 40, even if he were losing those Republicans who voted for him in 2016, just because he was the Republican nominee, if you reduce him just to his hard base, which may be 40, and if you look at the polls today, maybe a little south of 40, that would seem to give him at least a fighting chance in a three-way race. But it would also assume that there was not a party anywhere that was seen as opposed to both Donald Trump and the Republicans. And I think the Democratic Party might audition for that role in 2020.
But I guess the bigger question here is, has anybody figured out what he's up to here with doing deals with the Democrats?
No, I don't think anyone quite knows exactly what he thinks he's doing or whether it is part of a grand strategy or whether it's just how he feels on Wednesday and then how he feels on Thursday. So Chuck and Nancy, that would be Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leaders in the Senate and House, respectively, become his besties one day. And then the next day, he is sending out a completely different message on Twitter and then yet another message through some of his various surrogates.
Meanwhile, Senate Republicans are considering one last effort to try to repeal Obamacare. Leadership has been making a quiet push to gain support for the Graham-Cassidy bill. These are two Republican senators, which would replace some of Obamacare's payments to states with block grants and shrink overall funding. Do the votes exist for this?
The votes aren't there yet. We are told they have something like 47 or 48. They need 50 in order to get Mike Pence's tie-breaking vote involved. They were not able to get to 50 on any of the other versions of repeal and replace that they have brought to the floor. We know they don't have 50 quite yet because Rand Paul is out and several other senators have not committed one way or another. That includes Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Both of their states would lose a lot of their Medicaid expansion money. That's Medicaid expansion money. That would be the main reason that they probably voted against those earlier versions. Plus, we still don't know for certain there wouldn't be some of the conservatives joining Rand Paul because this particular version of repeal and replace would not repeal all of the Obamacare taxes.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. Ron, just in the 30 seconds we have left, I want to ask you about this tweet that President Trump sent out, a retweet of him hitting a golf ball that hits Hillary Clinton, doctored video. I feel like if any other president did that, this would be the story for the week.
Well, he does it because he's Donald Trump and he finds it amusing and he thinks that his Twitter followers will as well. And he gets away with it because he's right about many of those followers. And besides that, what does it even mean to get away with something in 2017?
That's NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The stock market started off this Monday at a record high, a very different story than October 19th, 1987, a date that would become known as Black Monday. The market dropped by 22.6% that day, equivalent to a roughly 5,000-point loss for the Dow today. What led to that crash is the subject of longtime New York Times financial reporter Diana Henriquez's new book. It's called A First-Class Catastrophe, The Road to Black Monday, the Worst Day in Wall Street History. Diana Henriquez, welcome back to Here and Now.
Wonderful to be here, Jeremy.
And we've talked to you about your other book, about Bernie Madoff. What made you want to dive into this crisis?
Well, the 30th anniversary, as you know, Jeremy, is coming up. And talking with younger people in my circle, even younger financial reporters, I was astonished at how little they knew about the 1987 crash. I lived through it myself as a reporter, but the mythology that has grown up around Black Monday is really an amazing monument to Wall Street amnesia, let me tell you. People will tell you, oh, it was no big deal. Oh, it was over in a day. It was one and done. And nothing could be further from the truth. So it was sort of, I kind of wanted to solve a mystery here. Why has Black Monday been so forgotten? Why have we not recognized what it was showing us and taken that to heart?
Well, why did you start your book where you did in the 70s? Because it seems to indicate that that was the beginning of what led to it.
Great question, and I'm glad you raised it, Jeremy. The book opens on the silver crisis, which was a bubble in the silver market. But what was significant about that crisis, which was in the commodity market, far from Wall Street, was the way it quickly leapt the traditional fire breaks. The panic spread from market to market, from the commodity market to the brokerage industry to banks and the various regulators of all those marketplaces barely knew each other's names. So we open on a world where official Washington is still kind of trapped in this delusion that there are all these isolated markets that can be regulated separately. And the silver crisis in 1980 blew that delusion apart for those who were paying attention. And then along the way, I illustrate the repeated occasions when a panic refused to stay where it was supposed to, so that by the time you arrive at Black Monday, you understand that this didn't just pop out of a clear blue sky. This was the culmination of a series of misjudgments, missteps, fundamental changes in how Wall Street worked.
Well, one of the fundamental changes was the rise of electronic trading. How big a role did that play?
It was an enormous role, and it was very unfamiliar to most investors at the time, particularly the Main Street investors, the extent to which computers were speeding the flow of orders into the marketplace at the speed of light. And many of those markets were still operating at what I call the speed of life, not the speed of light. They were human markets. They were trying to operate as they had operated for 100 years. And they were overwhelmed by the pace of automated order delivery. In addition, further in the background, in the shadows, beyond even the vision of alert regulators, were the use of computers to devise new and destabilizing trading strategies, to create new financial derivatives that were used in imaginative and unusual ways. So the computer was a tool of the financial engineers who were creating the new products that would so affect trading on Black Monday.
I must say, as you're talking about this, it sounds kind of familiar after having just lived through the crash of 2008. You know, people talking about a lot of fast trading and new products that nobody understands.
You're exactly right. I mean, in 1987, there were these titan investors who used these untested derivatives in computer-driven strategies, and they nearly overwhelmed the balkanized regulatory system. Exactly the same thing happened in 2008. Too big to fail investors using untested derivatives in high-speed herd investing strategies with fragmented oversight. So we're right back where we started, only with exponentially larger scale and risks.
Now, you've brought up the issue of regulators. You talk in this book about Ronald Reagan, who took office in 1981 and was pushing for smaller government, was appointing people who wanted to cut back on regulations. How much responsibility did Reagan and his administration have in the crash in 1987?
Well, it's sort of a mixed bag, Jeremy. Yes, there was a new deregulatory fever in Washington. The way that played out, however, was in skimpy rations for the regulators. So to the extent that the regulatory machinery was understaffed and underfinanced, that was a result of this determination to cut back on big government. But I should point out that after the crash, it was a blue ribbon commission appointed by President Reagan, led by a staunch Republican, Nick Brady, who recommended that we scrap our current regulatory system and put a unified regulator in charge in Washington. So both, you know, the prescription for what we should do and some of the problems that gave rise to Black Monday can be traced back to these political divisions. But I should also say that the Democrats in Congress on the left in the 1980s were not really part of the solution either. They wanted more funding for regulatory agencies, true, but they failed to undertake the serious oversight of these profound changes in the marketplace.
Well, and I wonder if we can ever expect our members of Congress to be able to be good regulators of the financial industry, because it is so complicated. How can we expect them to understand all of these new products enough to oversee?
Well, that's why we need to look at the regulatory structure we have. We don't expect our politicians in Congress to understand nuclear energy, but we do expect them to adequately fund the Department of Energy and make sure that the risks that that agency oversees are adequately taken care of. I think the same thing is true of our financial markets. Yes, they are extremely complex, and yes, they are algorithm-driven, and there's lots of rocket scientists from academia who are making fortunes on Wall Street, and that is arcane and bizarre for a lot of people in the political realm. But they still have the responsibility of making sure that the regulatory agency is appropriately structured, appropriately funded, and appropriately staffed so that it can understand what's happening on Wall Street, even if they can't.
Did you get a better understanding in writing this book of why crashes happen, how something that seems small can get out of control very quickly and spread and cause a market crash?
Yes, although it wasn't a big surprise. You know, we've been laboring for decades under the notion of an efficient market, a rational market, where investors make rational decisions, and those decisions are incorporated into the prices of securities automatically. I never found that particularly persuasive. I've got too big an appreciation for how people panic in a crisis. But after researching Black Monday, I don't understand how anyone can believe that that's an accurate explanation of how markets work. We're human beings. We bring a lot of baggage to our investment decisions. We get frightened. We indulge in wishful thinking. We ignore the red flags until it's too late. That's the nature of the human mind.
Well, and in your book, you write, quote, "Where does this leave us today, 30 years after Black Monday, exactly where we were then, in a storm-tossed lifeboat in which all the passengers are shackled together with the obnoxious crew members who carelessly steered our ship into the storm." So how likely is it 30 years later that we have another crash for the same reasons?
Well, we know we're going to have another financial crisis. We don't know when, but we know we will. How likely is it that we'll be ready? I will admit that I am concerned about that. I'm not sure that the focus in Washington is where it needs to be. There's a lot of talk about repealing and the Dodd-Frank law that was adopted after the 2008 crisis, tinkering with it around the edges. That isn't what we need. We need to wipe the blackboard clean. We need to start from scratch and figure out the best way to regulate this modern, hyper-automated, extremely complex marketplace where we find ourselves.
I'm sure a lot of people on Wall Street are going to read your book. What about people who don't work on Wall Street or don't work in the financial industry? What do you want them to take away?
I want them, first of all, to understand that this is not a mom-and-pop market. We're the mice on the elephant's dance floor here, and we need to understand our role. What I hope they will take away from the book is a clearer picture of how today's market works and how we got here. But I also hope they will realize that when the elephants are stampeding and running around with their ears on fire, what they should do, what you and I should do, is stay calm, stand pat, and wait out the storm. And then when the dust settles, call your representative in Washington and demand that we finally get some meaningful action on regulatory reform.
That's Diana Henriquez, whose book is called A First Class Catastrophe, The Road to Black Monday, The Worst Day in Wall Street History. Diana, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Another powerful storm in the Atlantic is threatening Caribbean islands that were devastated by Hurricane Irma. Forecasters said today that Hurricane Maria's sustained winds are now up to 120 miles per hour, and it is bearing down on the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. Further north, Hurricane Jose is moving toward New England and bringing winds and rain with it. Joining us on Skype is meteorologist David Epstein. David, it seems like Maria is the bigger threat here. As of today, it's a major hurricane, and it's getting stronger.
That's right. So it continues to look like it's going to stay a major hurricane. And when we use the word major, it's not just we're throwing a superlative onto the hurricane. Actually, there's a technical aspect to it, a Category 3 hurricane or higher, so 3, 4, and 5. We call them major hurricanes, so that's why it's called that. Winds are forecast to become as high as 130 knots, which translates into 150 miles an hour. That should happen over the next day and a half to 2 days or so. The good thing about this, it's a little further south than Irma was, so it's not going to go over the exact same area, but any wind and rain is just not good.
But we remember that one of the reasons Puerto Rico was spared from Irma for the most part is because Irma went north of Puerto Rico. This one looks like it may hit Puerto Rico head on.
That's right. This particular storm could actually cross the island. That would tend to weaken if it does cross the island. But you are correct. The fact that Irma missed them because it went a little further north, it impacted those northern islands like Barbuda. We saw all that horrible damage there. This particular storm is headed off towards the west-northwest, but it's just south of Irma's path.
When you look at it on the satellite imagery, it doesn't look as put together as Irma. It's not quite as clear of an eye, for example.
Right, exactly. And all hurricanes don't necessarily have a completely clear eye. Well-developed ones do, but just because we don't see a clear eye doesn't mean the storm isn't necessarily well-developed with strong winds. As you mentioned, the winds are well over 100 miles an hour at this point. I suspect that it'll start to clear out this afternoon as the storm becomes better organized. And then the eye goes through replacement cycles. So it has an eye, the thunderstorms around it kind of dissipate, it creates a new eye. And those cycles continue to happen until the storm eventually either peters out or goes over land.
And what are the chances that it will eventually hit the U.S. mainland?
Well, it's not zero, that's for sure. And depending on what models we look at, you know, it could impact the United States mainland. We just don't know once you get that far out. It just depends. I mean, there's some models that bring it very close to the southeast coast, say Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, in that area, and then curve it off towards the northeast. It may have some interaction with Jose and do what's called a Fujiwara effect, where they sort of almost dance around each other. It's like taking two dumbbells and you pull one down, the other has to go up. But it's just too early to say whether Maria is going to impact the U.S. mainland or not.
Seems like this is going to go down as a very significant hurricane season in the Atlantic.
It is definitely an active hurricane season in the Atlantic. There's no question about it. We're not as active as we were back when we had Katrina and Wilma in 2005. But one of the other aspects of this year is that we're coming off of several years of really below normal hurricane activity, far below average. And so one of the reasons for that is that we have less wind shear. There's no more El Nino. So that tends to allow these hurricanes to develop. It's a lot of different factors as to why we've got more hurricanes right now, but also it's comparatively much higher than the very abnormally low years we've just been through.
That's meteorologist David Epstein as we watch a number of hurricanes in the Atlantic. David, thank you.
You're welcome.
Lawmakers in Washington have given themselves 3 more months to reauthorize once again FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program, or NFIP, which was due to expire at the end of the month and is heavily in debt. Well, this is a thorny issue. National flood insurance has been around since 1968, largely because private insurers backed out of the market years ago. And so the government subsidizes the cost of insurance policies to encourage people to buy them. The problem is few people do. The pot isn't that big. Now, many people think, well, why should I buy it? The other thing that FEMA does is provide disaster assistance, which helps people rebuild. And you've by now heard that those people who do have policies, well, many flood over and over and are bailed out by the NFIP. Now, there's an argument, why should taxpayers bail out these repeat flooders? Over the next 2 days, we'll look at FEMA flood insurance. Today, with homeowner Dean Bixler in West Houston, who bought FEMA flood insurance just because it sounded like a good idea, and he's repeatedly flooded starting in 2009. In fact, he's a member of Residents Against Flooding, which is suing the city of Houston. Dean, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And we're glad to say that your home escaped Harvey, but you flooded 3 times in the past.
That's correct.
You had flood insurance. By the way, did your neighbors all do it?
Most of my neighbors did not have flood insurance in 2009. We are not in a flood zone. Wasn't required for the mortgage, anything.
And we should say it is required for a holder of a federally backed mortgage who lives in a flood-prone area. You didn't think you lived in a flood-prone area?
No.
Well, and then you flooded 3 times. Now, first of all, let's address this idea, and you know that there are people who want to do away with the National Flood Insurance Program. They think it's actually given people the incentive to move into flood areas because they know the government will cover them. You received payouts 3 times, $70,000 for damage in 2009, $50,000 for damage in 2015, $30,000 the third time around. But you say that's, you know, still only half the value of your home. What would you say to people who've said 3 times, you know, 3 strikes, you shouldn't be living there?
If I lived along a river or lived along the coast, I would completely agree with them. Unfortunately, ours is a man-made issue because of development on steroids in the area. They have solutions for my flooding. They were supposed to put in detention ponds before developing the area, and they didn't.
We've reported on this, that Houston is not only completely overdeveloped and has paved over wetlands that might absorb rain, but the requirement that developers had, many have ignored, to put in, you know, drainage ponds or to put in more wetlands. So you have launched a lawsuit.
That's correct.
Okay. So how do you feel about this debate over increasing the flood insurance, taking it away?
Mixed being a... I understand completely the opposition to the NFIP altogether. They are supposed to be coming out with some elevation-based survey and 2D modeling, they're going to find, because 70% of the people that flood in Houston are not in a floodplain, they're going to find that they moved that 70% of people into a special flood hazard area.
Well, let's jump in there, because FEMA is responsible for designating these flood areas. And a lot of people think the flood maps are completely wrong and due for an overhaul. And there are people in flood zones that aren't being called floodplains.
That's exactly right. And if they put me in a flood zone, and unfortunately, one of the things of FEMA is if you're bought your house prior to a change in the flood zone, you're grandfathered until you sell that house. And as long as you keep the flood insurance policy current, the next buyer, if they keep it current, are still grandfathered. So they don't pay the rates that they would be in a flood zone.
If somebody offered you full value for your house, for you to move, would you take it? In other words, a government agency said, you know what, we've got to get these, we've got to recognize these are flood zones, we've got to get these people out instead of keep having them flood and paying, which is a pain in the neck for you too. Would you take the value of your house to move?
Absolutely.
Huh. Dean Bixler, who owns a home in West Houston, Texas, with the group Residents Against Flooding. Dean, thanks and best to you.
Okay, thank you.
By the way, Dean tells us he's also invested about $30,000 of his own money to floodproof his home. Tomorrow, we're going to talk with someone who's studied the National Flood Insurance Program for years. He says it can and must be fixed. And now, a unique theater group. For many, there's nothing like being on stage. The bright lights, the rush of euphoria. But acting can feel inaccessible if you have certain physical or intellectual disabilities. Stina Sieg from KJZZ introduces us to a theater company in Scottsdale, Arizona, that welcomes everyone.
Not all the actors in Detour Company Theater can snap their fingers. But those who can are, during one of the final frenzied rehearsals before the opening night of, yeah, you might have guessed it, The Addams Family.
But I, too, am in love.
Esther, who is it?
The moon!
Down syndrome, autism, brain damage. Everyone in the cast has got something that keeps them from succeeding in a traditional theater setting. But here, everyone is worthy of stage time and feedback.
I love you, and I'm really proud of you, and you really rocked all your lines. You were so good, and you even remembered to cheat out the right way, okay?
She's doing amazing.
That's Sam, Detour's founder, artistic director, and the co-director of this show, who goes by one name only. Thin and small, she bounds up and down the stage for hours and exudes Mama Bear love.
Okay, and so then when you get the bird...
Most of all, Detour's about opportunity.
The opportunity for her cast of 40 to have what Sam calls an authentic theater experience. That means months of working hard, memorizing lines, learning choreography, and it means the opportunity for everyone to do the best they can in two musicals a year.
Our job is to make that learning and that make that success still possible for you, even with that other thing. You know, we all have things in our lives.
But backstage here at the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts, you don't really see those things. More so, you see people, happy people, like Sarah Rounds.
I feel like I'm free when I'm on the stage.
And Lance Winslow.
I feel like I'm somebody who, like, is like a real star when I'm here. You know, I'm happy to have that.
Leah Mapstead, now 23, has been part of Detour since she was a teenager, though she loved performing long before that.
When I'm on stage, I feel accomplished, I feel proud, and I feel like I'm having fun with a bunch of my friends, being someone I'm not for an hour and a half or so.
And Leah says they're not just friends here, they're family.
Brothers and sisters who work together as a team to put on miracles every year, twice a year at the Scottsdale Center.
I'm being pulled in a new direction. I think I like it. I think I like it. I'm being pulled in a new direction.
And maybe the miracles here aren't really the shows, though it is amazing that so many people of different ages and abilities can come together and create something so sweet and so fun. Maybe they're about how these productions affect everyone involved, not just the actors, but the coaches who shadow them on stage, and audience members like me, who cried through the entire standing ovation of Detour's last production. Founder Sam has seen a lot of that in the 15 years she's been doing Detour.
And people leave singing, dancing, smiling, laughing.
And hopefully with a new understanding of the performers they saw on stage.
Because they see them as people, as actors, as entertainers, as human beings with a gift to share. That's all we all are, right?
Including Sam's son, Christopher, who you might spot right away as the tall guy playing Lurch. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg in Scottsdale.
The dream that's coming true when the moon says I love you.
Stranger Things and Westworld were shut out at the Emmys last night. The biggest winners were Hulu's The Handmaid's Tale and HBO's Big Little Lies, both shows with strong female leads. It was a big night for people of color as well, and politics were front and center throughout the evening. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jeremy.
And there were a lot of politics last night, from Stephen Colbert's opening monologue to Donald Glover, who made a direct comment about the president.
I want to thank Trump for making black people number one on the most oppressed list. He's the reason I'm probably up here. And
then there was a reunion of 9 to 5 cast Dolly Parton, Jane Fonda, and Lily Tomlin. Here's Fonda and Tomlin.
Back in 1980, in that movie, we refused to be controlled by a sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot. Really? And in 2017, we still refuse to be controlled by a sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot.
Derek, in other award shows, we always wonder if there are going to be a lot of politics, and sometimes there aren't. But in this case, it really got political.
Donald Trump has never won an Emmy Award. But last night, he was the Emmy Awards. Mm. The opening monologue was devoted to him. The speeches were about him. The best comedy went to Veep, which famously tweaked its plot line to make room for Trump. Best drama went to Handmaid's Tale, a dystopian prophecy that many people considered to be of a piece with the Trump era. The show to win the most Emmys was Saturday Night Live, SNL, which had a resurgence in large part due to its political satire. And then to top it off, Alec Baldwin, who won an acting award, literally dedicated his Emmy Award to Donald Trump. And so in many ways, this was, as always, a celebration of television and the art form and the actors and writers that make that art possible. But almost every single moment was suffused with criticism of an awareness of this specter of the president.
Including the surprise appearance by Sean Spicer, the former White House press secretary, talking about the Emmys audience. Here he is.
This will be the largest audience to witness an Emmys, period, both in person and around the world.
Make a fun of what he did on Inauguration Day and talking about the crowd being so big. How did people react to that?
There were two reactions that I saw. The first was rather simply, this is amusing. And you could see it on the faces of some of the members of the audience. People were shocked to see him, but were laughing as he spoke. And I recall Colbert, I think, ushered him off stage by saying, thank you, Melissa McCarthy. The second reaction that I saw, though, was the critical reaction among political journalists and political-minded television critics on Twitter. Sean Spicer, I think, in many ways served as an agent of purposeful disinformation. He often lied pointlessly and falsifiably about issues as straightforward as, we just heard, how big was the inaugural crowd. And right. I think the feeling was now 6 months later, here he is being rehabilitated as someone for whom we should laugh about the pointless fibs. So, you know, for me, I understand both points. When I saw the moment, I did laugh, but I also understood the criticism from the left.
What does it say to you that with all of the great shows, and this is really, as we've talked about, a golden age of television right now, that The Handmaid's Tale, which is this Hulu show based on the Margaret Atwood novel about a dystopian future where women are oppressed by a totalitarian government, what does it say that that show won so many awards?
I think there's two points to make about The Handmaid's Tale. The first is that its success was clearly a reflection of the subject matter, which many people loudly interpreted as being prescient in the age of Trump, including fears of totalitarianism, a feeling of xenophobia, politicized misogyny. And then there's also the subcurrent in the plot of environmental degradation. And many people, as the show was coming out on Hulu, said, oh, my gosh, what incredible timing for this to come out at a time when so many are worried that all these issues are going to be an intrinsic part of our politics. The second important thing to point out is that it's just a great show. It was critically acclaimed. Elizabeth Moss was fantastic. And there were lots of other shows, as you said at the top, Stranger Things, Westworld, that were similarly critically acclaimed but didn't necessarily win the Emmys. So I think it needed to be at the center of both of these Venn diagrams, right? To be both a critically acclaimed show and to be seen as a parable for our times. And I think obviously no show quite hit that intersection quite as hard as Handmaid's Tale.
One more clip I want to play. This is Lena Waithe of Netflix's Master of None, who became the first African-American woman to win an Emmy for comedy writing, and she said this.
And last but certainly not least, my LGBTQIA family, I see each and every one of you. The things that make us different, those are our superpowers. Every day when you walk out the door, put on your imaginary cape, and go out there and conquer the world, because the world would not be as beautiful as it is if we weren't in it.
Derek, a big night for diversity at the Emmys.
Huge night for diversity at the Emmys across the acting categories and the writing. I mean, the Emmys ratified prestige television as an artistic medium that offers counter-programming to and criticism of modern politics. And you saw that celebration last night.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.